I'm Emily White, and this is the session on psychotherapy according to C.G. Jung. Welcome to the session, and as I said earlier, we can have discussion afterwards. This will be an overview of all the things I've talked about, and a review of what is psychotherapy all about. I myself am a psychotherapist in Minneapolis, and I work mostly with young people who are artists or would-be artists, and I try to help them develop their creativity. I would first like to tell you about Carl Gustav Jung himself, who next to Freud is the most well-known pioneer in the field of psychotherapy and the unconscious. He lived from 1875 to 1961. He was 84, almost 85 when he died. And the last thing he did was to actually write this book, Man and His Symbols, which is an introductory book to his work, written expressly for the layman, not for the psychologist. Jung was a brilliant man, but his German writing is difficult and convoluted, and the translations are not always the happiest. This book, however, was written in English originally. He spoke English fluently, and written specifically for the layman. The way he wrote it is interesting, and I've shared this before, but it bears repeating. He was approached by John Freeman of the BBC to write a book, a popular book, on his theories, because he was coming into prominence, and people didn't want to wade through all his long technical terms. He said, well, no, I'm 84, and I deserve a rest, and I really don't want to bother. But that night he had a long dream, in which he was in a big public place, and it was a great assemblage of people, workers, blue-collar workers, ordinary people, listening to him speak, and he spoke in English, and they understood him. He woke up from this dream. He went to the, well, not instantly, but the next day, he went to the phone, and he called Mr. Freeman. He said, I think I will undertake this project. So he set out to write this article and to get his co-workers to write other articles, and he wrote and edited the whole book and finished it about 10 days before he died. So there's one of your legacies and one of your ways of acting on a dream. You see, his conscious decision was, no, I don't want to. His unconscious was telling him, maybe this is what you need to do. That's a very big example. He was not only a pioneer in psychotherapy. He worked with Freud for about 6 years, and they disagreed over the interpretation of a dream, but also over the basic theory of the unconscious. Jung postulated that the collective unconscious, you could see the diagram on the board, was like an ocean within, in which archetypal tendencies, predispositions, universal tendencies, existed and came to the fore and were seen in dreams, that there was creativity and very powerful archetypal tendencies, images like the Great Mother, the Wise Old Man, guides for your psyche that resided in the unconscious. Whereas for Freud, it was libido and thanatos, libido being purely sexual energy and thanatos being the destructive energy, the death wish. They differed on that in principle and then parted ways. I would say that in many ways Jung is indebted to Freud, but moved beyond. Also, what I prefer about Jung is that he had a Protestant religious tradition which he carried on himself and insisted that you make a spiritual commitment in order to become whole. Whereas Freud was agnostic and reared in Victorian Vienna with an agnostic outlook, and thus the whole philosophy is colored in a different way. Jung also insisted that each individual, there is no such thing as a typical analysis, that you cannot say there are fixed symbols or a dream means thus and so. There are universal symbols, but the dream is unique, the individual path is unique, and we are stamped with a psychic thumbprint, so to speak, so that each person develops according to his unique gift, and it's the task of the psychotherapist to help him realize this potential, this is God-given potential that he is striving and struggling for. In addition to being a psychotherapist and co-worker of Freud, he wrote 17 volumes and many of these are now available in small paperbacks of a Bollingen series. So they're translated well. The first translations were convoluted, but these are fairly good. In addition to doing psychotherapy and research, he also delved into mythology and alchemy, and even theology. He wrote an essay on the answer to Job, which is very difficult reading, but it's kind of controversial. I don't know, are you familiar with it? One of the basic assumptions and laws are the laws of opposites that I talked about yesterday, the law of opposites. Everything turns into its opposite. There is the opposite between the conscious, the ego, and the unconscious. They're always at opposite ends. There are the opposites between the masculine and the feminine. Each person carries within them the opposite sex image. We call this the anima that the man carries around in his unconscious, and the woman has the animus, the male image. And here I might digress and say how we fall in love. When we fall in love, this unconscious image is projected onto a person, and suddenly this person is transformed. It's just wonderful, and you're just quite irrational about it, and you're in love until you pull this projection back and see the person for what they are, and then you can have a love relationship. Often there's a great disappointment because this fellow or this girl is not at all the wonderful image that you had projected onto them. But it's the beginning of a real relationship, and maybe this is important to remember for all of you young people. It's a necessary step. It's terribly painful when you suddenly realize, and when the archetype does not fit, then you have to go around and find someone else. And finally you will find somebody where it fits pretty well. And if both of you can mutually fall in love and work out a love relationship, then that's the joy that we all talk about. I already mentioned a collective unconscious. I also want to emphasize that the ego does not mean what we mean colloquially. Somebody asked me about that. Colloquially mean about ego. It means the structure of the psyche that mediates between the persona, the mask we wear to the outside, and the unconscious, the inner. The ego mediates between the persona and the unconscious. It has nothing to do with egotism, egocentricity, or anything. It's just a term that we use. We do have strong and weak egos. We have an ego that is so weak that it is overwhelmed by the contents of the unconscious. In that case, the person ends up often in a mental hospital. He cannot cope with reality. You have a strong ego, such that it's like a hard shell around the ego, and it doesn't let any of the unconscious come in to consciousness. This kind of person is rigid and repressed and ends up being perhaps compulsive. You know what a compulsive person is. Everything has to be exactly so. Cannot take risks, cannot let anything irrational, non-rational come into the psyche. If you have to err in one direction or another, it's better to err in the direction of being too rigid than to be too open, because obviously you can cope in the world. But for wholeness, for growth, you have to be open and allow some of the material to come from the unconscious, especially through dreams. And that is why dreams are so very important. They are the mirror that mirrors the unconscious to the conscious, and helps you understand that which is speaking to you, the spiritual, the wise guidance that resides in the unconscious. The more you listen to your dreams, the more they will speak to you, because they will send messages. It's a constant transmitter going there. It's like your radio station. You just have to open the switch and start listening. And I've done this for 20 years, and I'm quite amazed at how persistently these messages have been sent, and how sometimes I would listen, and even if I understood it consciously, it still took a long time to assimilate it emotionally and to act on it. This is, if the unconscious tells you to turn around, that you're going in the wrong direction, swimming against the stream, it may take a long time before you know how to make the U-turn in your life. And this is similar to the concept of metanoia and repentance, where we have to turn around and make a change in our lives. So dreams are important for understanding what the unconscious is speaking to you. And in psychotherapy, it is an essential tool, since it is the only way that the therapist can know what's going on in the unconscious. I always liken it to the x-ray. If you have a broken bone, we don't know until we get the x-ray just whether it's broken and where it's broken. And I would also hope that nowadays people will go to see a psychotherapist before they are in such a crisis that it's very difficult to work. If you have a physical ailment, you go to your doctor pretty fast, but when you have a psychic imbalance, you usually wait for a long while before you see a psychotherapist. You still have a slight prejudice. I mean, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong or that you're crazy at all. And choosing your psychotherapist is very important. We were joking the other day as to which shrink you choose. My shrink is better than your shrink. Back in Berkeley, we were always joking about this. My therapist is so much better than your therapist. Whether you should see this particular person or not depends very much on whether you could work together. And I always have an interview first to see if the person wants to work with me and if I feel I can work with them. And I'm not rejecting them when I say, perhaps you would like to call on this other person and talk to them first and make up your own mind, because you have to feel comfortable. And not everybody can work with everybody else. That's the way it is. I also feel that in a medical situation, you should get more than one opinion before you go into surgery. I'll share it. I had a problem with my toe, and I went to a doctor and said, off with the toe. Oh, I didn't like that idea. So I went to another doctor, and he said, well, if you can live with it, there's no reason that you have to go. Just use this medicine. So I preferred that path, you see. Similarly, in psychotherapy, there are different approaches, different personalities, and the unconscious has to mesh with the unconscious of the client. When we come to the concept of the shadow, you see, the shadow is your dark side, and you could see that if my client's shadow pulled my own shadow, as we say, if he would always pull my negative side, we wouldn't really be able to work together very well, because he or she would be pulling my shadow. So this is something you find out in the initial interview. The shadow concept is that side, that dark side that we don't like to see, but which is the first task in therapy. We have to come to recognize that side in us which we do not accept, but which is definitely there. That sort of demon that trips us up, that rears its ugly head, that makes us do things that we just, how did I ever do this? I mean, it wasn't me. It wasn't my conscious self, but it was certainly part of me that is in the unconscious. Yesterday we talked about types and came to understand a little bit how to recognize your weakness, that aspect that is, as we say, stuck in the unconscious, because you have three functions that you can work with consciously and one that is stuck in the unconscious. I would recommend you to listen to the tape, because I don't have time to go into the typology, but we talked about four types. We talked about thinking and feeling, sensation or sense-oriented, and intuitive types. After the session, we can talk about it a little more. Well, I've sort of given you an overview of Jung's work, and I would like to just round it out a little bit more by telling you also that he was not just a therapist, not just a man who studied books and did research, but he was also a stonemason who built a tower with his own hands. He was also a gourmet cook, and he wrote poetry and did some drawings. There's a whole fat book. He was not exactly an artist, but he did some very fine drawings. He was a versatile man, and of course, married and a father of several children, and the descendant of a long line of Protestant pastors. They lived in a town near Zurich in Küsnacht, and he always needed to live near the water. And I think, in view of everything he's written, that he felt that the water was an image for him of the unconscious, and it soothed him. He would sit for hours looking at the water, and I'd like to pass this book around so that you could see. Take a view of the first picture. He's sitting on the wall, much like we sit at Holden, looking like a farmer, looking at the water. And this other picture is Jung as a scholar. Why don't you pass it around and look on both sides? There's another opposite for you, you see. And he was able to balance these opposites. And I think, he's not here. We were joking with somebody this afternoon that I'm always talking about balancing opposites, but I think that's the essential task that is given to us. Not to get so one-sided that we sit only on one pole, but that we can move from one opposite to the other. I'm ready now to go into what is psychotherapy all about, more or less, and start with a quip. Somebody said, psychotherapists are the midwives of the psyche, for whatever that's worth. We do help give birth to those potentials that are buried or unrecognized by the individual. We urge, in a Jungian analysis, we urge the client to write down his dreams, and we spend most of the hour on analyzing the dream. In the session on dreams and dream symbols, I talked about how a dream resembles a drama, and there are protagonists and a dramatic situation, usually a solution, and the solution is often foreshadowed in the dream when you analyze it in depth. Everything that happens in the house, that happens, all the people in the house are often aspects of your psyche. And again, I urge you to listen to the tape because I don't want to go into all the dream symbols themselves, except to say that a dream that you remember that is a big dream will not only tell you where you're at now, as we say, but foreshadow where you're going without being prophetic. Now, we don't think that dreams talk very much more than about the tendency of the psyche and the dangers of the psyche. If you have prophetic dreams, it means you also probably have ESP already in your conscious psyche, so that you're more open to it. Do you agree with that, or?
No comments at this point.
Oh, no comments. All right, later. Okay. Now, the way Jungian analysis differs from a Freudian is that you're sitting face to face with the therapist, and you are not lying on the couch. In the Freudian therapy, you lie on the couch, and the therapist sits behind you. You don't even see him. There are all kinds of jokes. Gotta share it. This new therapist, Freudian, is riding down the elevator with his older colleague, wiping the sweat off his forehead. 8 hours of listening to all these troubles, 8 hours of all this pain. How do you stand it? He says, who listens? That's the great fear of all analysants, that does the therapist really listen? Because he's professional, because he sits there and doesn't, like a friend, say, and you know, that's what happened to me. and share his own life. He sits like a mirror himself and is somewhat cool. Therefore, sometimes they think he doesn't listen, but I don't think that happens too often. It's a joke. The thing about for the Jungian analysis, you're face to face, so you do get a response. And you do share some of your own life, but that's your own discretion. It depends on the relationship. Each therapeutic relationship is a unique relationship. And the best way I prepare myself for it is to be centered and I would take notes, to review the notes, but not to look at all the details and say in my head, now let's see, this is what I think he is and this is what he thinks should do. And I keep myself pretty open and try to speak to his center, to that part of the person that is precious and that is potentially growing, and to allow my intuition to let it flow and to have a dialogue. And that's why I said here, this is a definition if you want to write anything down. A process and a dialogue whereby the person is healed by drawing closer to the unconscious. You help them to draw closer to the unconscious by becoming familiar with the dreams and by understanding the symbols of the unconscious and allowing themselves to be guided by it. And the dialogue proceeds. And we never see a client more than twice a week because we feel they have to live in the world to test out the insights that they have acquired in the hour, in the therapeutic hour. And that is one of the other differences between Jung and Freud. The Freudians want them to spend all their psychic energy on the analysis, as well as money, parenthetically, so that they see them five times a week. And then you see you become so introspective that that's all you can talk about, and you haven't got a chance as much to test it out in real life. I feel very strongly that what you learn in the hour has to be tested out in the real situation, and then you come back. So it goes back, there's dialogue that way too. The aim of the therapist is to bring the person to a greater wholeness and balance, there's a word again, balance, and for him to recognize his individual path, the path of individuation that is his unique destiny, and his or her, please. difficulties that occur are a resistance. After the initial flush, after the initial transference, after the first two or three sessions, the patient is just builds up, if things are happening, will be very positive, will love the therapist and will put him on a pedestal and think he's wisdom incorporated. And it's very flattering, but also awesome. And then you come to a point where, let's say you're pointing out their shadow to them or something very unpleasant, and suddenly resistance occurs. That's a sort of second phase. Appointments are missed. They come late. Those are the signals. And what you say, I just can't buy this. This doesn't right. And then a certain amount of time has to elapse. And sometimes there's sort of an incubation period. Nothing much happens then. And then suddenly the person is ready. And then everything happens at once. It's like with the artist. Suddenly, after an incubation period, suddenly he knows just what to do and the picture can be painted in one fell swoop. There is an incubation period in psychotherapy where nothing seems to happen. That's when they all say, well, I think I'm wasting my money and whoa, and so forth. And then, and this is the mystery, we don't know when the person is ready to make that transformation. And then usually things resolve. And I usually allow the person to make the decision, the client to make the decision when and how they want to terminate. And then we have a 6 months checkup, as I say, just as you have with a doctor when you have had some kind of surgical intervention or whatever, you come for a checkup. And I think that's very important. And to keep to slowly build off and to keep in touch so that you don't cut off the relationship totally, which is still very threatening. The big danger in therapy is that you allow a dependency to occur, which requires the same kind of weaning as you have to wean a child, you see. And I've experienced this myself. I went through analysis and had a great transference on my therapist, and had to even go and see where he lived, you know, just to see the house, you know. Then I had terrible resistance, and then weaned myself by writing lots of letters and progress reports for so many years. Are you open for questions? It's almost 4:30. Anybody have any questions? Comments? Yes. Doing the homework, you see. Okay. There we are. Well, I think that one reason that I like to work in this field is that I am by nature intuitive and nurturing, and it's one way to professionally do this with a person. A friend can be a good therapist if your problems are not too difficult and if you can sort of help each other mutually. It's dangerous, and I want to warn people against that, to try to be the therapist in a marriage situation. I try and I hope I've succeeded not to do this. Even though we share our dreams, still I don't interpret them, or I don't play the therapist. It's not a good idea in a marriage. Yeah?
My question is about dream interpretation. Do you have, you know, I'm thinking of like a recurrent type dream that a lot of patients have. Are you talking more about symbols as far as interpretation of the dream? You see what I'm asking? Or is it an individual interpretation as to patient circumstances or how do you get out?
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, I interpret the dream by means of symbols, and these symbols are fairly universal, and I could touch upon them if you like. The house, for example, stands for the psyche by and large. What you do in the house, what happens at the threshold, the rooms you explore. If you are in the kitchen, that is a place where transformation occurs. And so the kitchen is an important place. And going upstairs and downstairs can be taken symbolically as becoming more conscious or going towards the unconscious. Very simple things like that. Going inside and out, the people in the house, aspects of your psyche. Unless it is the person that you're actually married to, you see, that usually is about the person. But the person's at a remove or totally unknown represents something in your psyche. And the person that you embrace or have sexual intercourse with, it's not the person you want to have an affair with, but it's something in that person that you want to incorporate. That's really important. And when you dream of death, for example, the person that dies or the thing that dies is what needs to die in you so you can be reborn. So that's kind of comforting, because death sometimes is very upsetting. We think it's not usually prophetic unless you also have ESP, you see.
Do people usually dream about strangers or people they know?
I mean, there's no usually. I'm saying when you dream of strangers, it's more likely to be aspects of yourself. And when you dream of somebody very close to you and you have the relationship going, it's usually about the relationship. That's a pretty good rule of thumb. Well, falling is a very universal dream and has an aspect, it's both mostly anxiety. But it's very common in adolescence, and some of it is physiological, rapid growth, you see. And while we're on that subject, when you cannot run, when you're being like you're chasing, you're lying there and you can't run, or the train is coming at you like in the cartoons, it often means that you're lying in a strange position, your legs have fallen asleep. There are physiological things that get transferred. Often when the alarm clock goes off, you can incorporate this into your dream, you know, like whatever the thing is that you're able to do, yeah? Thank you, that's a good question. REM sleep is the sleep of rapid eye movement, REM, and that is the time when you dream. They have found this true in the laboratory. With sleep deprivation is the lack of REM sleep, The body will somehow always get the rest, even if you have to catnap standing up when you're deprived of sleep. But you have to have a long period of sleep in order to have two or three periods of REM sleep, rapid eye movement, so that you can dream. The dream is the processing of what's gone on, and whether you... the processing of what has happened in your life. And why don't somebody wake him up? Have you had an ice cream? Would you like to share it? No. Okay. That varies now. What was the chart? I think it takes the first dream, the first sleep is very deep, and I think about an hour after you've fallen asleep. And there's about a 45-minute period. Then there is another deep sleep, not quite as deep. Then there is another REM of another half an hour, then another deep sleep, and then maybe half an hour. So that by the end of 6 hours, you have three REM periods. The last one is usually the lightest one, the lightest sleep period, and that's the one where you remember the dream. And if you really want to remember your dreams, I recommend you take a nap. For some reason, I don't know why naps. Why naps are so conducive to dreaming. But they are shallower sleep, and you wake up after an hour, of which maybe 45 minutes is, or more than half an hour, a greater proportion is REM, and it's very light, and so you are likely to remember the dream. Well, not necessarily. If you don't remember the dream, it may be that you're jumping out of bed too fast and getting conscious too fast, and I'd like to tell you how to remember dreams, if you wish. That is, train yourself to lie there with your eyes closed and to let the dream rise, to become really passive, not to think ahead, I have to go here and there, and I have to do this and so on, am I late? Don't open your eyes at all. Let the dream rise and have a piece of paper and just write down instantly the images, no matter how crazy they seem. And somebody else asked me something? Yeah, to let your eyes be closed until you're able to open them, so, and to very quietly, right, go into the morning, not to jump into it. And if you don't remember, that's it. If you don't remember your dreams, you may not be needing to listen to the message of the unconscious, or you are so busy in the outside world, you see. There's really no value judgment. If you want to remember them, you will. One of the things that's happened at Holden, as you probably know by now, is every other person comes up to me and either says, I can't remember my dreams, and there's something wrong with me, or, boy, I really had a good dream last night. So, kind of fun. I don't quite get, you mean, do different personality types have different kinds of dreams?
Well, for instance, okay, two thinkers mm-hmm. type personality, would they have a certain dream pattern, or would they?
I don't think so for this reason. To understand again that the typology takes place mostly in here, in the ego. Okay? The type is sort of like the cross and the ego, Dan, another meaning of the cross. So that this is your strength, but these are your two balancing things, and this is what's in the unconscious, remember? Now, therefore, this would not be, the unconscious would reflect the weakness, or would reflect from the shadow rather than from the consciousness, you see? Do you follow? Also, yeah. So that, remember always that you have the mediator, this ego, which is conscious, which receives the messages and processes them. And because the unconscious cannot be known any other way except through dreams or active imagination. Now, active imagination is something you can do if you don't dream. You can close your eyes and meditate and let these images rise. It means it's a great letting go. And not everybody can do it, but the other day in Matins we did a little bit of that, where he said, close your eyes and become aware of your breath and let go, you know. So dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Meditation and active imagination is another way. Mythology, which is like the dreams of a culture, embody all the wisdom and the archetypes, just like dreams, and fairy tales. Those are the main things. Therefore, I urge all parents to teach their children fairy tales.
What's happening there?
What hallucinations? When they hallucinate? I think it's a extreme form of projection where they project their unconscious so vividly that it takes a bodily shape out there, or they can hear the sound. It's because of the sleep deprivation. Yeah, I would say what you said is true, that the unconscious just spills over and embodies itself out there. It happens quite often. Are you a therapist yourself? Or?
No, I'm a nurse.
Yes, sleep deprivation can produce this disordering of the psyche to the point where the unconscious floods the ego, as we say. The unconscious floods the ego. Water images are very important. That's why dreaming and dream sleep is so important. It keeps you asleep and it keeps you sane, really. So,
Do we sleep in order to dream? I mean, I've heard that a couple of times.
Well, I think that I'd say we sleep in order to reconstitute, refresh our body and mind. You see, and then
I thought there was enough controversy over that as to whether we really needed it. But,
well, it seems that the evidence is that if you go without sleep, it's one of the greatest tortures, really. It's really essential. It's what is it? Sleep and food and sleep and sex. I feel the three basics. Anyhow.
Has it been found that certain social classes have approximately the same nuances to the dream symbols, or is it completely personal?
Certain cultures, certainly, your archetypes appear in cultural dress, okay? I think, if you can remember that, the wise old man will appear as a shaman to the Indian dreamer, and the wise old man will appear like a doctor to a Western, a command of the Western culture, and so forth. I mean, how the archetype is clothed depends on the culture, and what it means to you individually is what happens in therapy, you see. The symbols are universal, but the individual person or the individual symbol in your dream has a very individual meaning for you. And I'm trying to think of examples where you have to be careful if you're, let's say, a cave explorer and you're dreaming of caves, that has a very different meaning than if you're just an ordinary person and dream of a cave, you see. Because cave is a universal symbol. But if this is your job to explore caves, then it's a different kind of thing. Yeah?
Do all of your dreams supposedly come out of your, below the ego?
Yeah, the unconscious, yeah.
How do you explain it? I don't know whether it's really a dream or not, or whether it's a focus on a particular problem. You know, if you're working on a particularly difficult problem and you awake with the same perception as if it were a dream, you're focused on the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are famous examples of people who have been working very hard on solving a problem that they couldn't solve in their waking life, and then they go to sleep, and in their sleep they find the solution. They wake up. It's an insight that comes to them in the dream and consciously. I can't analyze it, but this has happened many times where the problem is solved. You say you have to sleep on it. That's another good advice, that if you're very emotionally upset now and you write this letter or whatever, you like to sleep on it so as to have a new perception in the morning. That doesn't mean that you're going to dream the solution, you see. I don't know if I'm answering your question there, but... Yes? Well, I really haven't come across that too much, but I would say that I would be supportive and try to say to them that the dreams, you say that in the dream they dream something that they will experience and see down the road. Mm-hmm. I would try to make it less you know, be supportive and take away the fear that they have, because it is awesome when you come across that. It probably means that this child also can do this in a conscious life. Do they have visions or anything like that?
Yes.
Maybe we can talk about that later. I really haven't come across that too much. Thank you. Well, I'd say 80% of all dreams is just what you're telling us. That's why it's so disappointing sometimes. You have dream after dream that's nothing like a rehash. I call it like mashed hashed potatoes or whatever. You know, it's just rehashing your experience. All dreams have an element of the unconscious in them, but it's like a little nugget. It's very hard to find. You see, what may seem like just a rehashing to you may be also have something very vital in it. The dreams I'm talking about are the big dreams or the vital dreams that really come from the unconscious and are guides that are mentioned in the Bible, that are the kind of things that shake you, you see. That's more than rehashing, you see. And that will come to you when and if you need it. See, that's another thing of trust. If you really need to hear a message, the unconscious is a very loyal, faithful guide. After all, if you think of the Holy Spirit as a comforter and a guide speaking through the unconscious, well, then this will be a faithful messenger to you when you need it. And that I find that very comforting.
Yeah. The opposite, is there significance to frightening nightmares?
Well, there can be warnings. Nightmares are the ones, of course, that you remember and that shake you in the opposite way. They are often the underside of a very positive thing. You see, that it would be, I have to talk about a very specific dream to give the answer to that. Remember that dreams are compensatory. That you may be here at Holden, I should tell you all that, in this wonderful, wonderful spot, relaxed and everything, and have quite a bit of nightmares or unhappy or violent dreams, because so many of your responsibilities have been lifted, you don't have to deal with your everyday problems. You're more open, probably, to your unconscious, and especially after these dream sessions. Then, if you are in a crisis situation, in a dark place, you may have a very encouraging dream that gives you a solution to your problem. That's, again, the comforting aspect of the dream. Well, I don't think you can define your own shadow. I'm talking now what happens in therapy. The first task for the therapist is to reflect to the person, to make him become conscious of what his shadow is and what's impeding his growth and what his weakness is. This is given by the dream, sooner or later. I'll give you an example. I have a client who had this dream of Mutt and Jeff, and I often tell him, do draw these figures. So he came in with the figures, and the nice guy was drawn surly, and the other guy, whom he described as bad and ugly and evil, was just smiling and lovely. And this very antithesis gave us a clue for working out what his real shadow was, what his shadow figures were. I don't want to go into the actual case history, but it was the first opening to the shadow figure. Sometimes the shadow figure is a dark-skinned person, or a threatening person. It really depends. It's usually of the same sex, though. That's important to realize. But mostly that person has characters that you despise or dislike. A burglar breaking into your house is often a shadow figure. Somebody doing, threatening you in some way, or doing something very evil. Is there another? You're asking vision or hallucination as against the dream, or just whatever? Oh. Well, let's say the prophets had visions, didn't they? They had the gift of prophecy. And I think this was a semi-conscious thing. Very much in touch with the unconscious, but able to see ahead, perhaps ESP. Whereas a hallucination, we said earlier, is usually the result of sleep deprivation or an illness where the unconscious floods through and gets projected and gets embodied out there. And it's usually very frightening, the difference. It doesn't have wisdom in it as a vision. Does. So much for top of my head definition. Yeah. Okay, we are about 5 minutes before the bell rings, we have 10 minutes before the bell rings.
You mentioned that there were two types of animals in dreams, helpful
and threatening.
Could you go into a little more what they would mean in a dream?
Okay, except for the snake, which we have said is a healing symbol, animals basically are either the helpful animals that, like in fairy tales, that come to your rescue, or frightening and dangerous animals that attack you. And that's about all I can...
So if they're frightening and dangerous, does that mean something in your life that you're afraid of, or...?
It can, yeah, it could. It often... I would say that would, or anxiety or something, but it would depend on the specific context. Very important to realize also at what point in your dream life, in your conscious life, you are dreaming. So that when you do write down your dreams, if you're going to do this systematically, for the few of you who do want to do this, write down a word or two as to what happened the night before. I saw the joy of Bach last night, for example. Then afterwards I dreamt of the Carters. Somebody came up to me and said that. Well, the Carters appeared in the Joy of Bach film, you see. So there was that strange, interesting connection. Wasn't it? They were thinking of the Carters, President Carter, that is. He actually appeared briefly, and it was kind of incongruous in that film, I thought. Just a little example. I'd like to end with one statement, and then you feel free to go up if you're hungry, and anybody wants to discuss and stay, feel free to stay on. Jung said that at all times, our task is to hold this candle of consciousness, this light of consciousness, and carry it against the adverse blowing winds. He liked the images. Carry the light against the adverse blowing winds of the world. And he felt that it was very important to keep raising your consciousness, to become more and more aware, to individuate, and to grow in understanding your own self, because to the extent that you knew yourself, you could be more giving and help other people and perhaps raise the consciousness of those around you as well.